Thanks, Tobias. It will already be obvious we want to make this meeting as informal as possible, so please feel free to interrupt at any time anyone with any reasonable question, and we will try to reciprocate by making ourselves accessible to people, both during these talks but also afterwards. The other venue for discussion, by the way, that didn't get mentioned by either of the prior speakers is after hours, and hours means 5 p.m. There are wonderful venues for discussion at the residence. So tomorrow there'll be specifically a barbecue, but every day there are both recreational spaces and maybe half a dozen different small meeting rooms, casual places to hang out and discuss. And when the weather is good, there's a beautiful set of spaces outdoors. So in addition to organizing things here during the day, people should feel free to organize things over there after hours, and that also includes the weekends when most people are not around this building. So what I'm doing is, the first speaker is trying to provide background. For many people, this will be redundant. For those of you who are in other fields, astrophysics or the like, I hope it will be a useful introduction to the subject matter. And I'm also going to try to give, well, I guess to tell the truth for a change about things that we don't understand instead of talking about things we do understand. So I will leave a bunch of loose ends that I hope will be matters that we can discuss in the future. As people in the field already know, our curiosity about how the ear works has two components to it. One of them is a practical component. We'd like to understand, as people have mentioned already, how the ear participates in the understanding of speech in all sorts of communications. From the clinical point of view, we'd like to understand what goes wrong with our hearing that affects on the order of 10% of the population. But the other perspective is that of basic scientists, neuroscientists, biophysicists, and we would like to understand the ear's remarkable properties. And there are really three of them that are extraordinary. The first is our frequency response. We can hear to 20 kilohertz. Bats and whales can hear to more than 100 kilohertz. Cindy can say what the record is. I know 120, 130 kilohertz is done by some bats, and whales arguably can go higher. So that's, you know, 1 or 2 tenths of a megahertz, which is not bad for something made out of, you know, fat and protein and whatnot. And one wonders how this system can operate to such high frequencies when our other senses are fortunate to operate at 10 hertz or 20 hertz or 30 hertz. With vision, for example, the flicker fusion rate is such that we see as a continuous image, television, motion pictures, and whatnot, where the frame rate is on the order of 24 to 30 frames per second. So how does the ear work 1,000 times faster than that? The second remarkable feature is just how sensitive the system is. So it's estimated that at the acoustic threshold, which is more or less 0 decibels, our eardrums vibrate by the range of a few tens of picometers. So it's a remarkably small distance. The internal workings of the ear vibrate by something on the order of 0.3 nanometers. So again, this is an atomic size, or anyway, a molecular size. So how can we reliably detect such small motions? We do it routinely all the time. And the third remarkable technical specification is the dynamic range of the system. Our hearing range extends from threshold near 0 decibels to about 120 decibels, which is the level at which hearing begins to be painful and the ear begins to be damaged. So that's 6 orders of magnitude in the amplitude of sound. It's 12 orders of magnitude in the power. So it's extraordinary to have any sort of transducer that can encompass 12 orders of magnitude in its power range. But again, the ear does that effortlessly, compressing that enormous range into just a couple of orders of magnitude for neural signaling. Because our neural signals extend only from, say, 5 spikes per second to 500 spikes per second. Just 2 orders of magnitude, there's an enormous range of compression. So the first thing we want to turn to is the nature of the transduction channel, the mechanism that's involved in actually transducing mechanical force into the electrical response. And this is done in the hair bundle. As most of you know, the hair bundle extends from the top surface of the hair cell. It's this very beautifully organized cluster of fine processes called stereocilia, a name meaning a stiff hair, that stick up. The distance is anything from about 1 micrometer in the case of a bat's cochlea to on the order of 80 micrometers in some low frequency auditory and particular vestibular hair cells. So a huge range in the height of this. Similarly, there's a large range in the number of the stereocilia, anywhere from 20 or fewer to more than 300. There's often a single eccentrically located process, this one with a 1 micron bulb on the top, that's called the kinocilium. The stereocilia are all rods filled with actin microfilaments. The kinocilium is a true cilium, like the ones on sperm tail and the like, that has microtubules at its core, a so-called axoneme, and is capable of active motion, though we don't know to what extent that active motion is actually used in the auditory system.
So Jim, if you go back to the previous slide there, so these stereocilia are supposed to touch each other only at the tip, or basically the tip of the shortest stereocilia are supposed to touch the side of the largest stereocilia?
Yeah, that's right.
So like that, it looks like they're all aligned and bent over. So how do we know that they aren't all, you know, kind of pushed together in the real organ?
Right. So first of all, what you point out is a real thing. There's an artifact in this picture. All electron microscopy is crooked, right? We always are looking, and I'm an electron microscopist, I can say that. There are always artifacts. So for example, this banana shape that you see here at the bottom is clearly an artifact of the fact that as you dehydrate the system to put it into the vacuum of the microscope, the system contracts, it shrinks. Typically the shrinkage is 20%, so it's quite substantial. And so that causes artifacts, including the one you're talking about. These stereocilia tend to be squeezed together, and in the worst cases, you get something that's sort of a flame-like tuft instead of nice stereocilia standing like this. But if you look at these preparations in the living state, when they're active and can transduce, you find that, in fact, the stereocilia are separated from each other along most of their links and become tangent, as you've already said, where they touch at the top. This is characteristic of all the vertebrate hair bundles. The stereocilia are never bolt upright. They always heel over towards each other and come into contact at their distant tips. And we'll see the importance of that in just a couple of minutes. Now, what we know about the transduction channels is first that they're relatively few in number. And this was first got by what's called variance analysis, just giving mechanical stimuli, pushing the hair bundle over and letting it go back, and looking at the noise in the signal. And the noise in this case, as in many neural signals, represents the clattering of large numbers of ion channels. So one gets a variance associated with the opening and closing of the channels. And by subtracting individual traces from the mean, you accentuate that variance. And you can see a band of relatively low frequency noise here and one that's here. And averaging those gives you this variance with these two peaks. And there's a simple model that says that the relationship of the variance to the mean, which is this I bar term, should follow this quadratic relation. And from the quadratic relation, you can adduce the number of channels and their conductance. And importantly, in the hair bundle I've shown you from the frog's ear, they're on the order of 100 channels. And there are about 50 of the stereocilia. So the suggestion is there are only one or two channels per stereocilium. That's a very small number. I mean, we're used to the fact that many cells, many neurons, have tens of thousands of ion channels. Here we have only a handful. And this is, in fact, why progress has been so slow in the chemical identification of the transduction apparatus. There just isn't enough of it there for conventional biochemistry to figure out what channels, what molecules are involved.
So, Jim, sorry to interrupt again. So sure. That assumes that the open that channel has exactly one open and one closed state, and you have a certain probability to transition between these two states. But I think both my channels have several open, or could have several open, or several closed states. Would that analysis then still hold?
Yeah, it would not. So this analysis is originally due to Fred Sigworth and Erwin Nair independently, and exactly the assumption you said is one of the two major assumptions. The assumption is that the channel is either open or closed. There could be other hidden states. That doesn't matter, but all that matters is the fact that any open state is either all the way open or all the way shut. They're not intermediate, say, so-called sub-states. And in general, this has subsequently been borne out. I'll show you a record subsequently. I guess the next slide, but one. But that would be an issue. The other important assumption of this relationship is that the channels are independent. They're all feeling the same forcing, and they're stochastically gating. If there were some cooperativity or something of this sort, then the rules would change. And you would expect, in fact, that this relationship should become skewed one way or the other, which is something that Florian is interested in exploring. Yeah? They are. I'll come to that in a moment, but you're exactly right.
That's why there's a limited number of them, because they're really disassociated with, I mean, not why there's a limited number, but they're associated with that part of the serious cilia, not the other part.
That's right. And so, for example, one might naively have supposed that the whole top of the cell is paved with them, right? That there could be dozens or hundreds of channels all over, and that something like membrane stress might be transduced to give the response. And that was the original idea. Most people believe that something like that was happening, or another possibility, which I personally thought was very attractive when it was first brought up, is that the kinocilium itself was the transducer. And we know that photoreceptor outer segments, which are the light-sensitive part, are based on the cilium. In insects, a large number of things, the cilia, whatnot, are uniformly based on ciliary derivatives. So the cilium had a powerful, even mystical, connection with transduction in general. So the hypothesis that was put forward by Hillman and others is that these stereocilia act like leaf springs. They're simply flexible elements, and you can imagine the flexible elements being tied to an elastic structure like the kinocilium. And if you now move this, you basically stretch or elongate the kinocilium, producing a response, and maybe it has channels all over it. The reality turned out to be when the kinocilium is pulled apart, actually micro-dissected from the rest of the bundle, life goes on as usual. The bundle does not much care. So the kinocilium, and sometimes the kinocilium just plain falls off when you do that. The bundle, the action is all over here. The kinocilium is important in one way, and this will be slightly obscene. When a hair bundle is formed, the kinocilium grows out first, and then the stereocilia grow behind it and pack up in sort of this nice arrangement. The kinocilium seems to be the orienting signal. If the kinocilium isn't there, if kinociliary transport, intraflagellar transport is abnormal, the hair bundle just does not form properly. So it's an important developmental cue, but it is not essential for normal transduction. Yeah. It is. That's right.
There's exactly one per bundle?
There's exactly one, yeah.
So your data already showed the ratio was more like two.
No. They're more like two per stereocilium. But these guys are not the ones with, only the kinocilium has the 9+2. These are full of actin. So the ratio says there are one or two channels per stereocilium, the actin-filled ones. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. So these are records from Robert Fetteplace and Tony Ricci, and they bear a bit on what Tobias mentioned already, the opening and closing of the channels. This represents a closed, this an open state of the channel, a brief reclosure, and so on. And in general, these records, as shown here, demonstrate a single open and a single closed state. What is remarkable about these channels? Two things are shown in this. One is that as you go along the cochlea, which corresponds to a difference in the frequency to which the cells are tuned, there's a gradient in the size of these channels. So towards the short hair cells, or I should say towards the high frequency into the cochlea in this case, the conductance becomes as great as 300 picosiemens. That's quite a large opening. That's a very conductive channel. And as you go towards the low frequency end, it falls, in this case, down in this calcium concentration, down into the range of less than 100 picosiemens. And these cochleas go on, so this could in principle go up to 400 or more and could in principle go down below 100. These hair cells at the two ends have simply not been explored. So this is one of many things that vary in a tonotopic way along the cochlea. Melanie Tobin's work, which she or Pascal will describe later, will tell you other mechanical things that vary along the length of the cochlea. But this poses a really interesting developmental question of how you have these thousands of cells along the cochlea, each of which is different from all the other ones. It's perhaps unique in biology. Jeff Holt's group has also shown different conductance levels, and he sees these conductance levels as being stratified into perhaps four or five different states. In this case, he is modifying one particular protein genetically. This is TMC1 or TMC2, two closely related paralogs that are thought to be part of the transduction channel. So depending on the mixture of those two, you get different conductance states, which is a strong indication that they make up part of the conductive pathway. This is just a doodle of the sort of thing that could be happening. You might suppose that there is a red type of channel molecule and a blue type of channel molecule, and the channel might be tetrameric. And I should say there's zero evidence that it's a tetramer, but many ion channels are. Then just depending on the number, the relative number of the two subunits, and also on their spatial relationship with each other, you could have a range of different conductances. And one possibility is that the previous data reflect exactly that sort of behavior, that a suitable mix of these two produces this range of different conductances. Now, where are the channels? This comes back to the prior question. If one simply stimulates a hair bundle, and then sniffs around outside it, asking where is the sink into which current is flowing. That's shown by these particular curves. The biggest signals are somewhat unexpectedly here at the top edge. The bottom edge, where the stereocilia are actually being bent, has the smallest signals. So current seems to flow in near the top. This was sufficiently controversial when first shown that several other people and other groups have repeated it. One way is by blocking the transduction channels, spraying with a pipette a drug that blocks the channels onto all these different positions while the bundle is being stimulated. And when one does that, one finds that the biggest effect, shown as this upward deflection, occurs here when the drug is sprayed at the top of the bundle. There's a negligible effect when the drug is applied at the bottom. So again, the channels seem to be there. And if one looks at the influx of calcium through the transduction channels, one finds the same thing. One finds that when the transduction is elicited by a mechanical stimulus, there's an insurge of current, and one finds a brightening of a calcium-dependent indicator, first at the top of the hair bundle, and then progressively farther down. So all of these are indications that transduction takes place at the tips. And the most recent and most temporally resolved results from the lab of Tony Ricci showed that when you give a mechanical stimulus, there is brightening at the tips of the stereocilia, but not those of the tallest row. So these hair bundles have about three rows of stereocilia. The second row and the bottom row, the third row, both show brightening, indicating that their tips have transduction channels, but the top row does not. So this leads to the idea that the transduction channels or at the bottom ends of the so-called tip links. So tip links are these filaments extending between the short stereocilium and the next longer one in front of it. They're on the order of 150 nanometers in length. The fact that the tallest stereocilia don't light up suggests that there are not channels at this end of the tip link. The fact that the shortest stereocilia do light up suggests that there are channels at this end. So the most economical model is that this is a passive insertion, that there are probably two channels at this end, similarly for each of these all the way through. And as you can appreciate, there won't be quite as many clusters of channels as there are stereocilia, because in general, those at the tall end won't have any channels.
So Jim, could you go back to the slide with the current at different locations, like the measurement of the current?
Yeah, sure.
Could you give us an idea of the spatial scale, so and also the spatial resolution? So that's measured with a micropipette, right? Like, what is the spatial resolution, so to speak, compared with the dimensions of that hair bundle?
Yeah, so this kind of a hair bundle is on the order of 7 or 8 micrometers in height. One thing that's exaggerated in every picture I show you here and now on is the amplitude of the motions. This hair bundle, it actually can be driven back and forth at threshold by 3/10 of a nanometer, and it's quite saturated by the time you go 100 nanometers. Now, the individual stereo cilia are 400 or 500 nanometers in diameter. So the reality is the bundle is just barely moving when one gives a stimulus. But again, this doesn't make a very impressive slide because everything looks static. So you will have to live with the exaggeration. In this case, the pipette is then positioned just outside the hair bundle at the position shown, and the resolution is on the order of a fraction of a micrometer, so it's fairly precise. And in this case, one is measuring an extracellular current flow, so you're actually seeing the voltage drop as current goes through the resistive medium into the transduction channels.
And have people look systematically as you go from the taller end to the shorter end of the bundle, like, is there variation of the current? I guess there is, because it's also hexagonal, but how would that compare, like, basically to figure out, are all the channels equal, or are the
No, it's a good point. That has not been, this was done quite a while ago, in 1982, and in fact, nobody has gone back and explored this with greater precision. It would be possible to do that, and, you know, basically map at a microscopic level exactly what the site of the current sink is, but it has not been done. Okay, so this leads to the gating spring model. And the idea of the gating spring model is something very simple. Somehow transduction is very fast. The response of the system, in fact, takes only microseconds at most. So there's not time, apparently, for the production of second messengers, cyclic AMP, cyclic GMP, what have you, as you have in some other transduction systems. Instead, the inference was that mechanical force is directly applied to some channel, that you've got a membrane, you've got an ion channel with a gate of some stripe, and somehow force is applied when the hair bundle is deflected. And the subsequent discovery, a year later, of the tip link by Pickles et al., it gave an obvious possibility, namely that the transduction channels shown here in blue with little red gates are attached to tip links, and that the tip links are the elastic element through which force is applied to the channel. So when the hair bundles move from a passive position, a resting position, to an active position, the shear between the adjacent stereo cilia is communicated to elongation of these tip links, which then pops the channels open. Now there's one geometric factor that ought to be mentioned before going farther, and that is there are two relevant values that you should know. One is the deflection of the hair bundle's top. That's called large X in most of these figures, and is obviously what the experimenter sees or does when he or she pushes on the bundle. But the shear between the adjacent stereo cilia is smaller than that. In fact, just from the geometry of the situation, you can deduce that the up and down motion, or the extension of the tip link, which is called small X, is going to be roughly proportional to the ratio of the separation of the stereo cilia and their height, something we call gamma. And for the hair bundles I'll be dealing with, that's about 1/7. So when you move the hair bundle here by 7 units, the shear is 1 unit. For displacements, the relationship is this. And for forces, this figure gamma also enters. The force applied here is in the number of stereo cilia, or number of tip links, times gamma, times the force that an individual channel feels. Likewise, the stiffness of the whole bundle is proportional to the total number of stereo cilia, gamma squared, and the stiffness of an individual spring. So the rudiments of the gating spring model are shown here. We start with the channel in its closed condition, and there's some energy involved in keeping it closed. We also start with an elastic element, the tip link, which has a certain stiffness, but is not connected. We first extend it by a distance x sub c to connect the two. We then suppose that mechanical force in the hair bundle extends it an additional amount, gamma times big X. When the channel's gate swings open, the spring is allowed to shorten by a distance d. And finally, there's an adaptation mechanism that I'll mention later, whereby movements elsewhere in the hair bundle relax the spring bend amount X sub A. And when you just do the geometry and the algebra, you get relationships for the force felt by an individual channel or the force produced by the whole hair bundle. The whole hair bundle force also includes a term owing to the stiffness of the stereociliary pivots, which are bending at their base. So that relationship predicts a bunch of things that have been verified experimentally. It predicts that there should be an open probability of the channel that follows a Boltzmann relation with X as the important stimulus parameter, X the displacement, on the order of plus or minus 100 nanometers opens the channels. This is the probability of opening. The force relationship between displacement and force follows this relationship that has a kink in it, and we'll talk a great deal more about that. It does not simply follow Hooke's law as a result of the channel's opening. And finally, the stiffness of the hair bundle is not a constant. There's a regime in which the channels are opening. The stiffness falls, and the stiffness could even become negative, which leads to some very peculiar properties. These properties could be measured by putting a fine glass probe onto the tip of the hair bundle, projecting the image of that onto a photodiode. One can then measure motions within a fraction of a nanometer. One can measure frequencies up to a few kilohertz. And in addition, by moving the base of the fiber, one can pull the hair bundle to the side. If the fiber is flexible, by measuring how much it bends, you can estimate how much force the hair bundle is producing. And that relationship, actual experimental relationship, is shown here. This shows the open probability, or in this case, the receptor potential, as a function of displacement. Again, the response occurs over plus or minus 100 nanometers or so. And over that same region, we see this decrease in stiffness, the so-called gating compliance. So a key player here is the tip link that I've already introduced. And the tip link is now known to be a dimer of dimers. It consists of two types of cadherin molecules. At the lower end, protocadherin 15, at the upper end, cadherin 23. These two molecules are then associated with a channel complex that's beginning to come into focus. I've already mentioned TMCs, the transmembrane channel-like proteins 1 and 2. They are almost certainly a component of the transduction channel's ionic pathway, so they're key to this channel. There are two other molecules, TMIE and TMHS, that have been shown genetically to be essential to the normal functioning of a transduction channel. If either one of them is lacking, the system does not work. But we don't know exactly what their role is. And there's until recently been confusion about another molecule, which is called piezo. This class of molecules, in this case piezo 2, are involved in many other touch-sensitive events. For example, touch with one's fingertips or the like is mediated through those channels. They occur in some hair cells, outer hair cells, and maybe inner hair cells of the mammalian cochlea, and their behavior is similar enough to this complex that there was confusion about whether they were one and the same thing. But recent experiments have knocked out piezo 2 and shown that this system functions perfectly normally. So piezo 2 seems not to be part of the transduction apparatus. Is it possible to dim the lights a little bit? It's a little bit bright for some of these things. I don't know what we've got over here. Yeah. There are far too many light switches to know what to do. It would be nice just to get a little more contrast. That's certainly better. Yeah, thank you very much. So these cadherin molecules are made up of what are called extracellular cadherin domains. Cadherin 23 has 27 of them, like beads on a chain. Protocadherin 15 has 11 of them. Each of these domains consists of 7 beta strands in a beta barrel winding back and forth. Here at the tips, they seem to overlap with each other. So Sotomayor and Corey have shown that the two most distal ends of each of these two molecules partially overlap, as you see here, and this interface between the two is stabilized by the binding of calcium, holding the two strands together. If you remove calcium below a range of a few micromolar in the system, it falls apart. The tip link breaks. Even though the molecule itself is not breaking, the two simply are dissociating from each other. You can think of each of these so-called beta barrels as being barrel-like, as being roughly cylindrical. But as I said, it's beads on a string. Each of these domains looks like this, and then there's a small connection between them, then another bead, and then another and another. We're seeing only the distalmost two of each of the two types. Also, it's dimeric, but we don't know whether these dimeric molecules associate laterally with each other or whether they're just two independent strands running side by side. Now, this kind of behavior and the nature of the tip link leads to an interesting phenomenon that has been tested. Joe Howard did the work originally, and you've already seen an illustration of it, and that is that the probabilistic nature of channel gating ends up causing mechanically detectable changes in the hair bundle. And in particular, if this is a channel, it looks like a channel, it's got a conducting pore, it's got a gate, it's got a tip link, okay? So the idea is if this is one stereocilium and this is another, the tip link bridges the gap between them, and when a sound hits this hair bundle, it goes back and forth, letting current in through the channel. If you came up and pushed on my arms, as you push, you would be doing some of the work elongating that rubber band. And the amount of work is the same if the channel's closed or if the channel's open. But in between, there's a regime when you begin to pull, now the channel opens, the rubber band goes slack. So the bundle actually becomes locally soft within a particular range of displacements. And in fact, that relationship I've already shown you, the relationship shows that the bundle does not follow Hooke's law, the straight line through the origin. Instead, it starts over here and then sort of slides across, going from all closed channels to all open channels. Now, this is one of the mysteries that we don't understand. Pascal Martin was instrumental in finding this and failed to explain it, and we still don't understand it. Basically, we used to do work in high calcium concentrations, 2 millimolar, and in that regime, one finds that gating causes this sort of slow change between the two regimes, and the distance between the two of them is in the range of a few tens, maybe 20 or so, or in this case 30 nanometers. One can then convert that into the apparent swing of the channel's gate, and according to the theory I showed you, this would be on the order of 4 nanometers, and for higher calcium it's even fewer. Now that's not totally absurd. An ion channel is on the order of 5 to 10 nanometers in diameter. You can imagine a gate, whatever that is, somehow moving 4 nanometers. If instead we go into a lower calcium concentration, and this is the physiological level, we find that this gap becomes much greater. Now we find 7, 8, even 9 nanometers. And this gets to be absurd. It's hard to imagine any protein that's say 5 or 6 nanometers in diameter, undergoing a steric change that's as large as 7 nanometers. Now, maybe there's simply something we are missing. Maybe this channel is very different from others, but it acts more as if something else is unfolding to produce this result. Another concomitant of this change is that the slope becomes locally negative. We actually have negative stiffness in this region, and we'll come back to the impact of that subsequently. Now, I should say that what is happening is not simply that the channels are becoming spread out in space. In other words, the fact that this relationship is broader likely does not indicate that the channels are gating some of them here, some of them here, some of them here, over a broader range. If you simply have a relationship in which the channels go from closed to open over a certain distance, and you now have many such channels displace differing amounts on the abscissa, then the sum of those will produce a much broader relationship rather than a narrow one. And more importantly, the relationship of force versus displacement becomes much broader and doesn't have this sharp and negative slope region. So it doesn't seem that just smearing things out would give the result we're seeing. The other thing which we don't understand is that the hair bundle acts as if there's a viscoelastic element. If one has a hair bundle that is entirely a passive structure being buffeted by Brownian motion, one would expect its mean squared displacement to follow a linear relation with time that on a log-log plot leads to a slope of unity. Instead, we find consistently sublinear behavior, as though the system is somehow dissipating energy. Also, by looking at its spectrum, we would expect a Lorentzian relationship of a passive system. And indeed, if we break the tip links, if we separate the tip links by removing calcium with BABTA, we get a beautiful slope of -2, as one would predict. But a control hair bundle that's alive and functioning has a lower slope, again indicative that there is some viscoelastic behavior in the bundle. This, again, we do not understand, and one wonders whether it's related to the foregoing issue of the change in behavior with different calcium concentrations. One thing that might be happening that's worth thinking about and talking about is that the cadherins of the tip link are not simply behaving as they do in crystallography. In crystals, you see these successive barrels side by side, and in the region where they're tied together, there are calcium ions, shown as green spheres in this case. If you apply force to this system, though, particularly if the calcium concentration is low, molecular dynamics shows that these domains can separate from each other by a distance of about 3 nanometers. And in a more extreme case, they actually start disintegrating. So here, one of the strands of this beta barrel structure has pulled out, and we have a much greater separation on the order of 7 or 8 nanometers. So we wonder, is it possible in the low calcium circumstances that prevail in vivo, whether these molecules actually come apart in a reversible way, leading to softening of the system and to a broader range of operation? And again, this is speculative, but I think an interesting thing to touch upon. Somehow, this mechanical compliance is occurring in this network. There are unfortunately too many places it could be occurring. The motor domains of myosin 1 are able to switch, and we'll come back to myosin 1 later, but there's evidence that myosin 1 anchors the upper end of the tip link, and myosin 1 is known to be able to switch between at least 2 states that supply a force but have different displacements. It's possible that this purple thing, which was not characterized at all, is elastic. It's possible that the neck domains, so-called, of the myosin can undergo changes. The tip link is calcium sensitive, as I've showed you. We don't understand that. It's possible that there are other links between the channel and the actin or in the actin itself that are compliant and produce some of these unusual effects. Let me go on then to the negative hair bundle stiffness that I've shown you already. Here again, we see this region of negative stiffness and contrast it with a linear relationship following Hooke's law. What this the negative stiffness indicates is something shown in this cartoon. If you take a hair bundle that's at rest and apply a probe to it, then move the probe through a large distance, it pulls the hair bundle in the same direction, and the elastic fiber bends back to the left. No surprise. But if you move the base of the fiber just a little, you find that the hair bundle moves farther than you're asking it to do. So in other words, you push on the hair bundle and the hair bundle pulls you farther in the same direction. There's some capacity of the hair bundle to work against an external object. And that behavior stems from the gating of transduction channels. This is an experiment in which a hair bundle was oscillating spontaneously, and then for a period of time, the drug gentamicin was sprayed onto the bundle, blocking the transduction channels in their open configuration. The drug was then turned off and the bundle began to oscillate again. What you find is that if you make measurements either before or after the drug is present, there is this region of negative stiffness. But while the drug is present, the system behaves in a perfectly Hookean manner. So it seems that this change in the elasticity is not something that the tip link itself can cause, but the transduction channel is directly involved. Our interpretation of this, at least the provisional interpretation, is shown here. We have channels that have gates. The gates swing a certain distance, d. They're attached to tip links of stiffness, kappa. If we have 3 such channels in parallel, and we apply a force, that force will be equally divided among the 3. But if one channel pops open, That reduces the force in the associated spring, meaning that the other two springs have to bear a greater force, which is brought to bear on the transduction channels. If a second channel opens, now the remaining channel bears a still greater force. So the tendency is that once a few channels have opened, the rest open in an avalanche. If the force is reduced a bit, once a few channels have closed, the rest of them close in an avalanche. The system, in other words, is bistable. It's stable when the force is low and the channels are largely closed. It's stable when the force is high and the channels are largely open, but it's not stable in between. So in fact, there's a stable fixed point here and a stable fixed point here, but the channel, the bundle, cannot reside passively in between those two states. Now, I'll very briefly mention some work of Andrei Kozlov, who'll be showing up tomorrow, examining one concern about that model. I've claimed that the channels are in parallel, yet we know that the force is applied here at the kinocilium and then to this first row of stereocilia, and it must somehow propagate across the rest of the hair bundle. You might suppose that a force applied, say, at the tall end here, will open this gap between the first two stereocilia and stretch that tip link. This will then get a smaller stimulus, this will get a smaller one, and so on as you go across. The cooperative behavior I just showed you demands instead that all of the channels experience a relatively similar force when a stimulus is applied at the top. So Andre undertook to understand this by looking at the thermal motion of the hair bundle, simply watching the hair bundle as it was buffeted by Brownian motion and asking whether the channels, whether the stereocilia, sorry, always move together or whether they can fall apart, whether there's breathing motion of that sort. He did this by making an interferometer with two independent beams, a red one and a green one, each of which was split into two orthogonally polarized components, making a micro interferometer. And in brief, what he found is when the two beams were aimed at the same place, the cross-correlation between them was identical to the autocorrelation of one beam with itself, which makes sense. They're both pointed at the same place. But if you now move one beam to the other side and repeat the experiment, the correlation, the cross-correlation and autocorrelation stay equally strong. So in other words, whenever this point moves the same distance or a fraction of the same distance and in the same direction. And the behavior is constant over a range of frequencies. The coherency, so-called, for the same position or opposite edges is quite high, anywhere from a few tens of hertz to something like 10 kilohertz. So most of our auditory range, at least. Excuse me?
There's no delay.
So there's no measurable delay over that range. Now, as you as you finally get up here, you begin to see some decoherence. And what is happening basically is, in this regime, inertia begins to become important. If one of the stereocilia here moves rapidly, then the mass of this one causes it to delay behind. But for lower frequencies, they're doing that. They're always staying in close phase with each other. And this was something of a surprise to us because we didn't think that the linkages between the adjacent stereocilia could hold them that tightly together. It turns out that it's not the linkages, and that was the surprise. We supposed that they could be pushed together by their insertions, held together by the filamentous linkages, held together electrostatically, or hydrodynamically coupled. And in fact, it turns out to be the hydrodynamics. So finite element analysis and a big computer showed us the fact that the system operates based on the fact that the hydrodynamic forces between adjacent stereocilia tend to pull them together. So here we have a range of different frequencies starting at a fraction of 1 hertz. The force is being applied just to the kinocilium, but as you see, as we start to enter the auditory range of a few hertz, all of the stereocilia begin to move together, even though there's no mechanical connection in the model between them. So the only thing holding them together is the hydrodynamics. And this continues all the way up, as I said, to about 10 kilohertz. At that point, they begin to show some separation.
No, still, for many mammals, I guess hearing does go above 10 kilohertz?
Yes.
On the other hand, also hair bundles look, well, are shorter at kind of in that high frequency region. But again, if hydrodynamic coupling is the main source of the coherence, then these short hair bundles would also basically that kind of face the same, so to speak, for tall and short cilia, right?
So there's a question.
You get the same separation at 10 kilohertz also for these short gamma.
That's right. So you wonder how a bat or a whale can operate at these higher frequencies, because you're exactly right. There should really be a problem. So to deal with this problem, I asked Cindy Moss to kill a high-frequency bat and send it to me in the mail. And when I get done with the meeting, I'll go back to sectioning it. We're trying to find out exactly that. I'm suspicious that the thing doesn't work the same way. In particular, the limited number of published pictures in the system show that in the bat, you start seeing something like this, in which the shorter stereocilia, so this is only 1 micrometer, this would be half a micrometer, they're almost orthogonal to each other like that. Now imagine you've got a tip link between those two and you drive just this one. You would be pulling directly on the tip link with high efficiency. It would be a very neat system. And you know, it's in the plastic. I just need a couple of days and we'll answer your question.
Like, for inner hairs, for inner hairs, outer hairs?
That's an outer hair. I'll look at both, but I mean it's the outers in which I'm particularly, they're the ones that show this extreme behavior. Because otherwise you're right, it really does not make sense. If you want them to do the same thing, they should readily start falling apart at these high frequencies. But if you were doing that, the problem would vanish.
But that can only happen for 2 roles, right? But we have 3 roles?
Yeah, so that's already known. From the few published pictures that have been made of these, they seem to have just a couple of rows. Sometimes there's another small row nearby, but they really look like that, as I was pantomiming. I think it's cool. I like these bats.
There's a question about the hydrodynamics. Is it sufficient to use Stokes equations, or do you have to use Navier's?
So we use Navier-Stokes, but for the simulation. So it's the full Navier-Stokes, but incompressible liquid, and I think that's a good assumption. The Reynolds numbers, even when you get to relatively high frequencies in this system, the Reynolds numbers stay pretty small, surprisingly small. You would think 100 kilohertz, it must be huge. But in fact, it's the very small dimensions, the L term in the Reynolds number expression, keeps things under control. So I think this is a perfectly good approximation. And basically what's going on is that when you pull on the tall stereocilia, there are two choices that a pair of adjacent stereocilia have. They can pull apart, or they can remain together and shear longitudinally. Pulling apart, though, necessitates that fluid, liquid, be sucked into the narrow space between them, and that's energetically very unfavorable. Whereas this longitudinal shearing does not require any of that kind of separation. So in fact, the drag coefficient associated with this mode is more than 1,000 times bigger than this one. This one is sort of frozen out in favor of the shearing mode, and the bundle stays together. So we have channels in parallel with each other. They stay in parallel over this broad frequency range, and any force that's applied to the bundle seems to be distributed equally among them. Now, a couple of other phenomena. Something called slow adaptation. If you apply a force to a hair bundle, you see transduction channels open, current flows into the cell, which has a negative sign, but within a millisecond or so, about half of the current vanishes, so in other words, half the channels close, and then another half of those channels closes with a time course of about 20 milliseconds. So these are two processes of adaptation, a fast one and a slow one. And associated with those, there are two mechanical signals. The hair bundle under a constant force first moves in the positive direction, but then abruptly jerks backwards as about half the channels close. And finally, it sags farther in the same direction as additional channels shut. And we're interested in both of these processes, what causes the closure of channels and the concomitant change in the hair bundle's displacement. The model that has been developed, and I'll show you some of the evidence in a moment, is shown here. The notion is that the hair bundle starts at rest, you deflect it, that puts tension in the tip links, that opens the channels, current flows into the cell, the hair bundle undergoes a particular displacement. But now, tension is taken out of the tip links by downward sliding of the upper insertions of the tip links. That has two effects. As it slides down, tension goes out of the links. This means mechanically the hair bundle gets softer and you get this positive motion. And secondly, as tension goes out of the tip links, the channels are allowed to reclose, and you get this sagging of the transduction channel. If the system is deflected in the opposite direction, you get something of the opposite effect. The channels first close, so this is the real zero, and this is simply a passive response. But now the upper ends of the tip links climb up, and that restores tension in the tip links. This causes a mechanical change in the opposite direction, and it causes an increase in the transduction current, particularly when you restore the hair bundle to its resting position. There's this little surge of current. Now, the stereocilia are full of actin. The motor system that clamps on actin... Sorry, go ahead. Sure. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and there's another subtlety to it, as I'll show you in a minute. The fast process, which may be involved, for example, in the amplification of sound stimuli, as Pascal and I and others will talk about over the next few days, that process has a very narrow range. It operates only over a few nanometers. Yet, there are circumstances in which the hair bundle may be pushed way over here or way over there. So, for example, if you go up in an airplane and the ambient pressure changes, there may be changes that cause the basilar membrane and other things to move. Just plain development is not likely to get things right within a fraction of a nanometer. So anything that causes these large changes wants to be nulled out. And this process I'm talking about now, which we call slow adaptation, I think is dominantly doing that. It is basically transposing the response along the abscissa. So wherever you happen to be, the response is almost as good as anywhere else. And in particular, the vernier sensitivity to fast stimuli is high everywhere. So I actually like to call this slow process adaptation. The fast one I don't think is really fundamentally adaptive. As you'll see, I think it's more involved in a motor process that powers the active process that amplifies our hearing. So anyway, given that myosin is likely to be involved, one could take advantage of what one knows about myosin. Myosin binds ATP, hydrolyzes it to ADPPI. When the PI, the inorganic phosphatase, leaves, this system becomes tightly bound, so the actin and myosin are stuck strongly to each other. There's an irreversible power stroke. Then ADP leaves, the system dissociates when ATP binds again, and it returns and undergoes another cycle. There are a number of predictions along the way. This step requires calmodulin. This step is promoted by calcium. This step is blocked by these substances. This step by ADP and its analogs. And all of those things have been tested. All of these have been borne out. Everything fits with the idea that there's a myosin-based process in slow adaptation. There are a number of myosins present. The one we first pointed out is something called myosin 1C. Myosin 1C is found in the hair bundle, particularly along its beveled top surface at the tips of the stereocilia. And other groups showed by electron microscopy that it seems to be clustered at the top ends of the tip links around the so-called insertional plaque. So our belief is that there's something on the order of 50 or 100 of these myosin 1C molecules at the top end of the insertional plaque, and that they control the tension in the tip link. The channel here is no longer, we no longer believe it's at this end of the tip link, but rather at the other end. Now, again, there's a qualification here that's worth later consideration. Bashara Kashar and others say that by immunohistochemistry, they can't find myosin 1C in the hair bundles of mature mammals. So maybe there's another myosin, particularly myosin 7A, which does occur there, that might be involved in this process. But there is evidence that myosin 1C is involved, particularly in the developing mouse. These are experiments by Peter Gillespie, Jeff Holt, and others. The binding site of this myosin 1C is shown here from a crystallographic diagram. It's blocked at its top surface by a big tyrosine residue. And as a result of this tyrosine residue, it's not possible to put into this slot a modified ADP molecule that has this methyl butyl sticking out of the top of it, simply because the methyl butyl would collide with the tyrosine. If one, however, makes a mutant in which you remove the tyrosine and put in a small glycine residue, now this thing will fit into this specific myosin. So it's sort of a neat trick. You have an animal in which all the myosins are normal, all the other flavors of myosin are normal. None of them can use this molecule, nor can this molecule block any of them. But only in the mutant myosin 1C, this molecule will fit into the binding cleft. And lo and behold, when you put that molecule in, the adaptation is blocked. So this is pretty strong evidence that at least in immature mice, the adaptation motor is in fact endowed with myosin 1C. It plays an important, maybe the dominant role. But this, in any case, remains controversial. A little bit about hair bundle oscillation. I've already said that this is a stable fixed point and that's a stable fixed point, but in between, the hair bundle is unstable. So if the adaptation process pushes the bundle into the red range, the bundle's got to do something to escape. It's got to jump to the opposite side. And in fact, this was tested by Dolores Bosovich, who'll be coming to the meeting a little later, and Loic Le Goff. The notion is that when a hair bundle is oscillating spontaneously, there will be phases in which the bundle is in the negative position and those in which it's in the positive position. When it's in the negative position, the speculation is that the motors have climbed way up and that the displacement force relationship has migrated to your left. When the hair bundle is in its positive deflection, the motors, we think, have slipped down, the relationship has slid to the right. So they did various trickery to measure the oscillations, detect transitions between the negative and the positive positions, trigger a complicated clamp circuit when those transitions occurred, and then measure individual points of the force displacement relationship just after a positive step or just after a negative step. And in brief, what they saw is what the theory predicted, namely that just after a positive deflection, after the bundle's been in a negative position and jumps positively, the displacement force relationship is like this. After a negative transition, the displacement force relation has slid along the abscissa. So what we think is going on as a result of the slow adaptation process is this. Let's start with the hair bundle with an open probability of 50%, an equilibrium value, but it's in the unstable regime. The bundle will jump to one of these positions. Now the open probability is relatively low, so adaptation tries to raise it. The system begins to shift until the stable fixed point vanishes. Now the system jumps to a new stable fixed point, but now the open probability is quite high. Adaptation tends to shift to try to bring it back into the right range until, again, it reaches an instability, the system jumps back, and so on. So oscillation occurs because the thing goes back and forth between those positions. And indeed, the experimental data and various model simulations fit for a whole range of operations, including spraying on calcium to speed up the process, chelating calcium to slow it down, putting a load on with a displacement clamp, and so on. So we think we understand this process quite well. Yeah. Yes?
What are the conditions under which it oscillates? Is that kind of normal, or is it some odd condition?
So you'll be hearing a lot about that in the next few days, and Pascal will talk about it. We think that these slow oscillations that I'm showing you are an experimental artifact of the fact that the hair bundle has been deprived of the otolithic membrane or tectorial membrane that's normally holding it in place. So there are two pathologies. One is that it's free moving. The other is that it's decoupled from its kin, right? So ordinarily, adjacent or nearby hair bundles will be talking to each other through their common connection with the tectorial structure, and there'll be some averaging of noise over that ensemble. So in the intact system, we think that the oscillations are much smaller and they're at a higher frequency, and I'll show you in a subsequent talk our evidence for that. But we do have some understanding of the circumstances. We can in fact show you, and will show you, a state diagram of the conditions of the force and the elastic load applied to it in which the bundle is either static or spontaneously oscillatory. Just a quick note about pharmacology. The evidence suggests that something like protein phosphorylation controls the extent of these behaviors. Most of you will know the system of protein phosphorylation in which calmodulin binds calcium and becomes activated. It activates adenylyl cyclase, which makes cyclic AMP. That in turn activates protein kinase, which puts phosphates onto various targets. And myosin 1C is probably one of those targets. So indeed, there are drugs that either support this by promoting phosphorylation, they're shown in yellow, or those that block it by blocking phosphorylation, they're shown in pink. If you apply those drugs to oscillatory bundles, you see, again, something that's consistent. Those that promote phosphorylation slow the system down and sometimes make the oscillations larger. Those that block phosphorylation speed things up and sometimes make them smaller. And if just blocking myosin blocks the whole thing altogether. So the last point is fast adaptation, this other process. And here we have much less understanding. Again, fast adaptation occurs immediately after a force transient. It's over in a millisecond, and in the mammal it's even faster. What we know is that it requires calcium. So the simple model is that calcium comes in through the transduction channels and binds somewhere, but we don't know where. Is it to the channel? Is it to some myosin-associated molecule or whatever? And when it binds, it recloses the channels. And as you can appreciate, if a channel recloses, it puts additional tension in the tip link. If you have additional tension in the tip link, that pulls the adjacent stereociliary tips towards each other. That then moves the hair bundle back in the negative direction. So this produces a little machine in which you provide a force in the positive direction, but then with a little delay, it produces a force back in the negative direction. And that actually can be harnessed in a useful way. The work that the hair bundle's done can be got from the binding energy. So here's the simplest possible model. You have a calcium ion. It binds using some binding energy to accommodate a particular site, but additional binding energy is then used by producing some mechanical relaxation, producing force through a distance. In other words, doing work on this external system. And the work that you can produce is shown here. We know inside the channel, inside the stereocilia at rest, the concentration of calcium is only about 50 nanomolar, whereas measurements with calcium indicators have shown that during stimulation, it goes up to nearly 40 micromolar, so a relatively large three order of magnitude change. That means that the entry of one calcium can do work that's of the order of 7 times KT, 27 kilojoules. So you don't need too many calcium ions going in and binding in order to do useful work and to actually drive the hair bundle back and forth. So there are several places that calcium could be acting. It could be acting up on the myosin end, but as I've shown you already, we think the channels are not here, so the myosin is not so likely to be involved through this process. It could be directly reclosing the channel by acting directly there. It could be acting inside on the actin or on other cytoplasmic constituents. But this is still something that's up in the air. It could also be acting through changes in the states of the myosin, and this is something Florian has been exploring and may get a chance to talk to you about. The system can be very fast. If you calculate what would be involved in calcium flowing in through the transduction channel, getting to its binding site, binding and then unbinding to reprime the system, you can make realistic estimates of time constants that suggest this could operate to 15 or 20 kilohertz. And with a smaller volume and other changes, you can get it to operate to 50 kilohertz or more. So certainly the timing is not damning for this mechanism of fast response. So the bottom line of it is this could make a machine. You can have a machine in which sinusoidal stimulation first pushes the bundle in the positive direction and then back in the negative direction. And as you go around each cycle, channels open, calcium flows in, calcium binds, produces additional force pushing the hair bundle back in the negative direction. And if it's properly timed, in each cycle, this binding of calcium will add energy to the system and amplify the input signal. And in fact, the subsequent talk that I'm going to give and some of the talk from Pascal and Frank Ulicker and others will deal with the consequences of this model. How does amplification occur? How does the ear's so-called active process operate to sensitize our hearing, but also to account for the tuning and the very broad dynamic range that I mentioned at the outset? So that's everything I have to say for now, but I'm happy to take more questions if people wish. Sure. Go. No, I shouldn't mean to exclude that. So, and I have comments about this in the other lecture. So there's another mechanism involved as well. Outer hair cells of the mammalian cochlea, probably uniquely, though there's some evidence from the chicken, these outer hair cells are endowed with literally millions of copies of a protein called prestin. And prestin is an unusual protein that has piezoelectric behavior, that is to say, change in the voltage across it causes a mechanical change in it, or vice versa, a mechanical force applied to it causes a change in voltage. So the notion is that these outer hair cells really have two mechanisms of amplification. They have active hair bundle motion that we'll talk more about. But in addition, changes in the current flowing into the cell and the voltage inside cause changes in the length of the cell. In the mammalian cochlea, the latter process may be dominant in terms of actual work. So if you ask, you know, how much work is done by the system in amplification, our current estimate is that 80% or more of it comes from this contractile process, only about 20% or somewhat less comes from the hair bundle. These are mostly from the frog. I've mixed some things together, but the majority are from the frog. And this is a matter of experimental accessibility. The bundles are big, they last well in vitro, and so on. Nobody yet, as far as I know, can do an essential thing with the mammalian bundles that we can do with the frog. And that's something I haven't talked about. But in the intact ear of essentially every animal, you have hair bundles fitting into a space that's sort of a privileged compartment. This space contains a fluid called endolymph. Endolymph contains a very high concentration of potassium, a low or moderate concentration of calcium, a very small concentration of sodium. Everything else here is ordinary extracellular fluid. It's high in sodium, it's low in potassium, and relatively low in calcium. It's a neat trick from the evolutionary point of view. If a transduction channel opens here, potassium flows into the cell for two reasons. First, the inside of this cell is at a resting potential of minus 70. And second, in the mammalian cochlea, ion pumps put this compartment at a voltage of plus 80 millivolts, maybe a plus 100 millivolts. So there's something like 150 millivolts driving potassium into the cell. But when potassium goes into the cell, it depolarizes it. The nurse potential across the bottom side of the cell is such that potassium will then flow out passively. So the hair cell does no net work. The hair cell can respond with huge currents flowing through it, but it doesn't have to do any metabolic work to get rid of the potassium. Somebody else has to schlep the potassium back, and there are big ion pumps, a whole epithelium called the stria vascularis that does that, okay? To get, then, the interesting properties of the hair cell, one has to recapitulate this in vitro. You need a circumstance in which the hair cell has endolymph on the top surface and the other solution, ordinary extracellular fluid called perilymph, on the bottom. We can do that with these frog hair cells routinely, but with the mammalian cochlea, the thing is so small and has such a funny shape and so on that that has not been done. So we don't think yet that we have a good sense of quite what the mammalian hair cells really do until we can achieve this configuration. Yes?
Ecologically speaking, the frogs that you work with, how fast a reaction time do they need based on the hearing in order to survive or do something?
Well, they don't have to be particularly fast. The frog's hearing only goes up to a range of a few hundred hertz to maybe 1 kilohertz. They have two different hearing organs, one that's relatively low frequency, one up to about 1 kilohertz. And so the time constants involved are are relatively long compared to what the mammal, particularly the bat or the whale, has to achieve. And so this is the reason, in fact, I showed that slide about the timing of the system. It doesn't require any very special pleading to make the system potentially fast enough to go up into the range of tens of kilohertz. Whether there's anything really special happening at 100 kilohertz, I really can't say. So I should say, I think everybody will back this up in subsequent talks. We face a lot of technical issues in this system. It's simply not an easy dollar to do these experiments. You start with the hardest bone in the mammalian body. You then drill a hole in it, which is like a jackhammer, and try to take an incredibly sensitive structure out of it. So the fact that anything works is already a minor miracle. Yeah?
So the displacement that you're delivering to the bundle, how is that achieved?
So we typically use, there are three different mechanisms. One is to use just a rigid glass rod, by rigid I mean on a microscopic scale, driven by a piezoelectric actuator and applied to the bundle. And in fact, if that glass is very clean, or if it's derivatized in various ways, it will stick to the hair bundle quite tightly. So when you move the piezoelectric device back and forth, you can drive the bundle reliably. The second thing is similar to that, except that instead of having a rigid fiber, you have a flexible fiber. And with the flexible fiber, you can then use a piezoelectric driver and use a photodiode to see how much it flexes. And then you can measure conjugate variables. You can measure how far you've deflected the bundle, but also how much force the bundle is producing, force and distance both, by measuring the flexion of this fiber. The disadvantage of that system, both systems really, is that when you're moving these fibers back and forth at higher and higher frequencies, the drag on the fiber itself begins to become significant. So we have a roll-off that makes it hard for us to do experiments above a few hundred hertz, maybe a kilohertz. And we're trying various things to get around that so that we can examine higher frequency cells. The third way of doing it is to use a so-called fluid jet. And that's simply to use a piezoelectric device to drive liquid out of a pipette. So you simply blow on the hair bundle, and for small displacements and for reasonable frequencies, you get quite linear results from that. Melanie has done some beautiful experiments calibrating these systems and showing what the flow field looks like around it. Pascal, will you present that material?
Sure.
Okay. In principle, they have the data, and it's quite nice. So that system has the advantage that you can give higher frequencies and get quite good behavior. It has the disadvantage of not having a direct calibration of the force. You can infer the force, but you can't measure it directly because there's nothing flexing or responding to it.
I guess, yeah, what I found myself wondering is that I was looking at your topic, the extent that you can actually mimic basal membrane, the effect of basal membrane motion on the hair cell bundle in this clinical trial?
Yes. So I agree. That's a somewhat tricky issue. And again, it would be nice to have an experimental preparation in which you can go from soup to nuts in the same preparation. Start with an intact basilar membrane and then show how that responds to sound, how then basilar membrane motion is communicated to hair bundle deflection, how then hair bundle deflection is converted, is transduced into force and so on. We have no preparation in which we can do all the steps in one common preparation, even in the same species or even in the same organ. In fact, what you'll see in other talks, as well as in this one, is the picture is sort of pieced together, you know, blind men and an elephant. You have a little bit from gerbils, a little bit from zebrafish, a little bit from rats, a little bit from mice, a little bit from frogs. Mostly the picture is coherent, but there are certainly loose ends, you know, places where we would like to connect the dots. Yeah. Yes, so, no, that's right. So, and I should say there's a beautiful literature, a really deep and rich literature of modeling in the system, driven both by, I would say, intellectual prowess and by desperation, right? It's a combination of the fact that we can't make the direct measurements. So Tobias has done some very nice modeling, but there are many laboratories that have done just what you've said. It's just that in some cases we're dissatisfied. For example, as the basilar membrane moves up and down, you have a hair bundle sitting on this membrane. So here's the membrane, it's going up and down. The hair bundle is now sticking up. It's sticking in a tectorial membrane. So what we think is happening is as the basilar membrane moves up and down, that's converted into a tweaking of the hair bundle, which is the sort of thing that I've been studying in what I talked about today. But though we have some measurement of this up and down motion, we don't have a really clear picture of how these two communicate. For example, the tectorial structure itself has internal, the tectorial membrane itself has internal structure. It's not isotropic. It may have modes of oscillation. It may be tuned to a different frequency from the basilar membrane at that same point. There's evidence for that. So there are multiple, you know, sort of second and third order terms that are important in the system. Those we haven't collared. Pascal will most definitely talk about that. You're going to do the cyberclones.
Yeah,
so he'll give you a detailed answer to that. First, we'll introduce more details about this active process, the amplification, and Pascal will talk about that. It works. So you should come. Okay, should we knock off?
All right, thanks a lot again.